your host, Dmitry Filipovich.
Welcome to the Hockeypedia Cast. My name is Dmitry Filipovich, and joining me here in studio on this Monday, starting the week strong, my good buddy Thomas Dranz. Tom, what's going on?
Oh, not much, bud. Just enjoying. That was a fun weekend of hockey. John Hines blew my mind. NFL free agency, obviously tracking that closely. Thatcher Demko injury news, big preoccupation on Canucks talk today. Lots going on. It's been a fun weekend. Nice to take a deep breath after the trade deadline, but I'm excited to share some sober second thought reflections with you on what went down and what it all means today.
Well, the trade deadline's over, but just because that's the case does not mean we're going to stop here. And I wanted to say, I think people really enjoyed last week's slate of PDOcast shows. We did like 6 hours worth. I was really proud of it, but I want to keep it going. Instead of taking a step back, I want to keep building on that momentum. And despite the fact that the deadline festivities and all the madness that comes with that is over with, we're going to try to do so here. And I don't know if it's going to be sobering necessarily, Tom, because I think the best way to fight the hangover is to just keep going. And that's what we're going to do here. I don't want to stop podcasting. I want to keep talking hockey.
This is the hair of the dog deadline recap.
Exactly. So here's the plan for today. I know it's not quite as exciting as the two segments of the season kind of sandwiching it, right? You have this brief period after the deadline before the postseason. But I actually think it can be a good time for us. It's less stress. We can kind of worry about we don't have to worry about checking our phone every couple minutes and anticipating breaking news that we have to instantly like plug into and react to for our job. So we get to just kick back, watch these games, and see how all the pieces fit as teams jockey for position. But before we do all that, I want to sort of put a bow on the trade deadline with you in particular, because I tried to get to as much of it as I could on Friday's 2-hour show. Mm-hmm. I think there's obviously still some meat on the bone. You can only really get to so much at one time, but also we've had the benefit now of this weekend to sort of marinate on this, think on it. And I think in particular, rather than the sort of what in terms of what happened, I want to get into the why and how with you, like the mechanics of sort of the behind the scenes stuff for the deadline in terms of the business at play. I think that's probably, I don't know if you agree with this and whether it's a feature or a bug, but it's kind of the most underappreciated part of pretty much every deal these days, right? It's typically sort of featured as like, this player is going to this team, this is the return. But in reality, a massive consideration guiding all of these moves is the financials, right? In terms of like the capability of a team to actually facilitate it, all the moving parts of that. And so I think that's like a fun segue for us, I guess, here to finish off the trade deadline talk and then get into the stretch run here.
The best example to illustrate sort of the business side, right? How things alter as the deadline nears is how rarely you see these big retention deals earlier on in the season. But at the 11th possible hour, everyone's willing to retain. Everyone's willing to...
Not everyone.
Not everyone. Sorry, Arizona.
31 teams.
31 teams.
Yes.
But, you know, and it's because by the time you're here, right, but especially when the deadline's March 8th and the season ends officially on April 16th or whatever, and you're only looking at 38 days of prorated salary, the numbers are actually far more manageable than you assume, right? You're talking 150K here, 250K here, rounding errors. From the perspective, whereas earlier in the season, you're looking at way bigger numbers. It's unbelievable how the retention dynamics alter and are so unique to deadline season. And, you know, gave this deadline in particular a feel that like the cap was fake, that the hard cap, you know, instead of being this all governing force in the league, through the prism through which we must analyze everything, all of a sudden became a matter of, you know, a matter that creative front offices were able to navigate around, something that felt optional. I think that's only good for the game, despite everyone whining about Vegas LTI to the point that Kelly McCrimmon had to come out and do the old Wedding Crashers thing. Like, oh man, we lost some really good men out there.
Playing for the Yankees? So that's my question for you then here. Let's start off with that. Do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing in the grand scheme of sort of the health of the league in terms of like drumming up excitement and conversation and dialogue amongst fans? And the reason why I ask you this is because on the one hand, I think the league clearly sort of prides itself on this idea of parity, right? And how like it's really tough to separate yourself from the pack. And then especially in the postseason with the volatility of the sport and the 7-game series, this idea of, I don't want to upset you here, but anything can happen. That's at least the way the league sort of presents the playoffs, right? That's all well and good. I think that the issue, though, is you get into these circumstances where it's a bit strange that, like, you read these reports how it's like the Kings are really interested in Riley Smith, but it's just too complicated for them to pull off this deal. Or you get, like, Ilya Lyubushkin requiring a third-party broker to facilitate a trade. Obviously, the Leafs doing so they could go out and also add Joel Edmondson, and I understand all of that. But when you take a step back and sort of view it through that lens compared to, like, how other sports operate, it is a bit strange. Now, for nerds like us, like, it's like, yeah, it's cool. Let's add three more layers to this that we can unpack. But for a fan who's just like, who did my team get? It's definitely, like, a bit obscure.
It's more fun with more activity. It's more fun with more possibility. You know, the biggest, like, just from a fan's perspective, the biggest day of interest around the Vancouver Canucks across the last 5 years since I've been covering the team was the day the Canucks executed the Oliver Ekman-Larsson buyout. Like, that was more interesting based on how many people wanted to read about it to fans than the Pettersson extension, than the JT Miller trade, than the Miller extension, than the Bruce There It Is bump, than the run through the bubble. Why? Because it opened up possibilities, right? Like, it created a sense that, like, hey, now this team can be better. And they in fact were, but it was the possibility that people reacted to. Possibilities, things to hope for. That's what fans want and respond to. And I think an environment where you've got, like, regular cap growth and the ability to actually make moves and teams actually finding ways to execute deals that blow your mind, like the Tomas Hertl deal, I think that's all upside for the sport.
Well, to that point, my buddy Dave, who does analytics for the Victoria Royals, mm-hmm. who was in studio with us on deadline day, is a Canucks fan as well. And when we were here in studio on Friday following the festivities, he opens up his laptop and he starts typing in cap friendly, and it immediately redirects him to Oliver Ekman-Larsson's buyout page because he had been visiting that so many times.
Right.
And so, to illustrate your point on that, there's that. What else was I was thinking of was sort of, I mean, first the market and the prices, right? Did it feel to you like, for, I guess, some of the reasons we've hinted at so far, the returns were relatively depressed? Like,
yes.
I think, like, the Flames, like, in particular, the two deals, and it's apples and oranges because we know that centers typically just get valued more by the market, right? So guys like Sean Monahan and Elias Lindholm have that working for them already baked into that price. But those teams that acted quickly, rather than waiting till the final week,
almost
it feels like almost
price.
Got the best returns in terms of, like, what the Habs and the Flames got compared to what we were seeing the day of, where you have Tyler Toffoli going for a future second and a third in deals that I think we all thought were, this is a pretty reasonable price for a team that can sort of meaningfully improve its roster and compete for a Stanley Cup. I would pay that every day. Now, the number of teams who could facilitate that were few and far between.
So I'm a little bit split. I mean, I think there's a lot of seller teams that thought that Calgary set a market that was favorable to buyers, right? That's like some of what I'm hearing from various people around the business. You look at the Lindholm deal, and there was a ton of assets in the deal. But when you really, like, stop and actually think about it, right, it's like Kuzmenko's a deal that, you know, I think the Canucks were beginning to view as a potential liability, something that might actually be difficult or require extra cost to get off of. Yoni Yermo, I think, was 50-50 to ever be signed by the team. Hunter Brustevich, that's an interesting prospect, high upside guy, but one of those volatile prospects. Like, the upside case is really compelling, but the Ty Smith case is also really compelling. And then a conditional fourth. I mean, it seems like a lot, but it's kind of not. And I think the Monahan thing, like, I think Montreal was one of the very few teams that benefited from the market Calgary set by acting quickly. Outside of that, you know, and I even think you can poke holes in, like, that Calgary package. Like, I just think this shaped up to be a wildly favorable buyer's market at the deadline. I think there's a few forces at play here, and I think one of the ones that most shaped what we saw, especially in the case of the Gensel deal, was how few trades involved actual top prospects.
Mm-hmm.
Like, with the exception of Vegas parting with Edstrom for a long-term piece in Tomas Hertl, did anyone trade that one of their three best prospects? I don't think they did, right? Like, you saw Grushnikov types. You saw Carolina trade some like second round guys who are tracking well, but you know, industry opinion tends to not view those as impact prospects. Teams really held tight. Like, teams were willing to part with draft capital to some extent, but they weren't willing to part with their top prospects. And I do think that even with cap growth upcoming, the promise of cap growth upcoming, what that really does sort of emphasize is how much teams are still obsessed with the upside of landing like a major contributor, like a real contributor on an ELS. Like, that's still something that teams are obsessed with. And I thought this deadline activity really bore that out on a global scale.
Well, deservedly so. I mean, totally. Obviously this is the extreme and sort of the highest end possible example of it, but you see sort of the impact, like the Stars being able to call up a Logan Stankov and just having him basically slot in and immediately start producing in a top six role. Like, the value of that for the next, not just the rest of this season, but the next 2 years after that, and then beyond, obviously, because you have the cost-controlled asset, is massive. I would even stretch that out to just, like, young contributors in general and lump in, like, Nils Höglander here as well.
Sure.
Right? Where, like, the idea of him, he's already got 25 on 5 goals, which I believe is, like, top 10 certainly in total, but also, like, top 3 when prorated in terms of his usage at $1.1 million next year. Like, that is just an enormously valuable contributor. And so I understand, like, it makes sense that teams would prioritize, that are already firmly in this window, would prioritize guys, considering they probably already then have a lot of high salary players on their roster, guys who can step in and play for cheap, as opposed to someone who might help them 4 or 5 years from now, which a lot of either draft picks or like B prospects are. So I think that totally makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's, there's a lot going on there. I think some people would suggest, and some people in the industry have suggested to me, that one of the reasons why you see that too is like a simple bias where the idea is if you trade a draft pick and then that team selects a player and then that player goes on to be something.
Right. It wasn't your player.
It wasn't your player.
Right.
Right. And that some of this is
just kind of like a self-dunk, because you're basically implying like, hey, our scouting staff wouldn't have identified that player. It's like you're kind of admitting that, if anything, the team should be like, oh, we totally would have taken this guy who panned out.
Yes. Right. So it's like the, yeah, I mean, I do think there's an element of that, like an element to which there's a risk mitigation factor at play. But I also do think that fundamentally it's a product. That's one of the big products of the cap era, right? The notion of the first player prospect package, we do still see it. We saw it for Bo Horvat last year, but it's increasingly rare.
Right.
Right. That's just something that's going kind of out the window. And I think that sort of dovetails nicely with the discussion of the Gensel deal, where, you know, I think the Penguins have been carved for it. I don't know exactly how you feel about the package, but I think the overall value of that package is probably better than what the Flames netted for Elias Lindholm, and by some margin. Like, I'd say it's 150% more than what anyone else netted for a player. But it took such a different form than we're used to seeing, right? Because they are getting 3 prospects back, and we know what the premium is for these types of guys relative to draft picks. And then they don't get the guaranteed first. And to them, that's inconsequential because they got the rarer pieces, the pieces fewer teams are willing to part with. But it looks so different than what we're used to a rental package looking like at the trade deadline that I feel like it kind of broke people's brains a little bit. People weren't able to digest the actual price paid.
Right.
In part because the form was just different than what we're used to.
Well, I'm not sure if you would agree or think that we've already arrived at this point, but I do wonder if there's kind of like a paradigm shift to come in the sport in terms of viewing it through the lens of like, I feel like teams generally are so preoccupied with having their roster like fleshed out by October 10th or whenever the season's starting. And it's like, we need to just fill out every lineup spot and have all our guys locked in and go into the first game of the opening season or the regular season with our roster ready to go. And then obviously performance is wildly going to vary. You're going to have injuries, all sorts of stuff's going to happen. But you'd almost be better served carving out that space and sort of more patiently waiting to make sure that you have the lineup you want for April 1st or whenever like the final couple weeks of the regular season are to preserve that flexibility, if you know what I mean. Obviously you're sort of playing the risk of if you don't have a fully fully formed roster and you struggle at the start of the season, you have to actually make it to the playoffs to begin with. But it feels like in hockey, everyone is just so focused on, by the time we come to July 1st, it's like, all right, I've got $12 million in cap space. I need to use $12 million in cap space because it's burning a hole in my pocket, as opposed to sort of taking a longer term view of, let's keep room open so that once we get through these kind of benchmarks in the regular season, we can actually pounce when prices are depreciated the way they were this trade deadline. And that's why a team like the Hurricanes, who does that more diligently than anyone else, was able to act in a variety of ways because they actually are a contender who does have that flexibility.
Well, you're sort of bringing up one thing that I found annoying, like in the wake of the Kraken expansion draft, where people were like, well, the GMs were wise to it this time. And it's like, for this week,
right?
You know, if that team had preserved cap space for 2 or 3 flat cap seasons, like, these deals would have still come to them. You know what I mean? They just would have come to them in a slightly different form. Boston for a few years has used the deadline to shop long term, right? Charlie Coyle, Hampus Lindholm, like, we've seen this team target players at the deadline and then extend them. So they're doing long term shopping in an environment where teams are occasionally a little bit more limited in the number of parties that they can deal a player to.
Right.
Vegas has started doing this more. I mean, they've always kind of done it, but like Mark Stone, when they acquired him, was a pure rental. At least he was on that timeline.
Right.
Right. Now they extend him, but now we're seeing Vegas operate totally differently. Right. And like now we're seeing, cause you have the Stone.
Well, I think they tried with Tatar. Obviously, it didn't work out. But, like,
yeah,
that was part of the logic as well, right? Sure. I had this guy who's going to be on this team for a while as opposed to just a pure rental.
And I mean, Barbashev and Stone would both be the, like, expiring guys, but they end up retaining.
But if it's a good fit and we're very confident they're going to like it here, we'll be able to retain them.
Aiden Hill, too.
Yes.
But the Hurdle deal is, like, the most poignant, clear example of Vegas's MO, right? Of Vegas's sort of Boston Bruins on steroids approach to using the deadline and the sort of leverage point, the inflection point that comes for teams forced into making decisions here. You know, to instead of looking at it as like my final opportunity to add a finishing piece, a third line center or a fourth line center, penalty killing ace. And they'll still do that. I mean, they traded for Mantha, but that price was reasonable, right? The Hanifin, like what they're really willing to pay for are the guys who are coming as long-term fits explicitly. Hanifin, Hurdle, right? And that to me is a new world. What I'm curious to see is whether or not that comes to be more of the norm, right? I think Carolina obviously bought Kuznetsov and Gensel. I think they'll fancy their chances of keeping Gensel. Who knows?
Right.
With Kuznetsov, that's a true flyer, and we'll get into it more. But, you know, I'd say that's sort of another example, albeit less explicitly, of a team that had no need in either the Gensel or Pettersson trade talks to have an opportunity to discuss an extension with the player, because they're comfortable renting the guy, but they're also bringing them in with a view toward the long term. I think that's a fascinating sort of mini dynamic, like a mini distillation of the overall a Bruin strategy, which Vegas has now put on steroids and taken to the next level.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And when I say sort of maintaining flexibility in the way of resources, part of that is cap space. Part of that is also, to the Canes' credit, like volume of prospects to also into as well, right? Where you said like no one moved any of their top three prospects. You could probably even say the Canes didn't move like even their top 5 or 7 or however you want to rate these guys. But then that speaks to the job they've been doing the past couple of years in accumulating guys where their 10th prospect might be the 3rd or 4th best prospect on another team. And so that's kind of part of this consideration.
Guy would be the 3rd best prospect in a lot of organizations, right? A 5th, like a leading scorer in Liga at the age of 20. If that guy was like a Toronto Maple Leafs or like a Alberta team prospect, people would be like,
You'd
be hearing a lot about him. But because he's in Carolina, him and, you just don't hear much about them.
I did want to circle back to this because someone over the weekend in the Discord posted about how, like, I think they said, oh, I got whiplash from listening to you praise the Golden Knights for sort of with reckless abandon, aggressively mortgaging picks and cap space to add players, while also then crediting the Stars for sort of taking a longer term view with their first and their development system and doing that way. And I think that's kind of the point, though, right? It's like, as long as you have a defined plan and then you stick to it and execute it, I don't think there's necessarily a one size fits all in the NHL for like how to go about building a sustainable contender, right? I think where we bump into issues is when teams sort of by the seat of their pants are like going one direction and then maybe things go differently than they expected and then they pivot and change their plan on the fly. And then in the offseason, they go back to spending and then they're kind of all over the place going back and forth as opposed to like following through on the plan. Even if it's not necessarily the best plan, at least if it's like defined and then you continue with it, you can almost like you can see what's happening as opposed to just the back and forth.
Well, that's what kills you. Right. Those quick directional changes.
Because you're losing like slight value with each of those turns, right? And then like in the aggregate, that's what kills you.
Well, I'll give you two examples that I'm deeply familiar with. One was the Florida Panthers, right? In that 2015-16 season, they have that PDO Bender season. They win the division, right? Everything looks like it's on the up and up. And then they quickly change for about a four-month period to a more progressive style of management commonly associated with the Computer Boys. And then Dale Tallon comes back in charge. And, you know, so you've got this team built a certain way that all of a sudden gets like small on the blue line and brings in Marchessault and Riley Smith. And it makes sense. A lot of good players acquired, a lot of smart extensions done. And then you switch back to the other mode of operating. And it's like, whoever was right or wrong, like both made some decent moves, both made some mistakes. But the key was that switching between those two viewpoints in quick succession, like three switches within the context of a year, left that team muddled until Bill Zito came in and sorted things out. I think likewise, like in Vancouver, what you saw was this team was trying to build this perennial playoff team. And then the pandemic hit and the budget got lean. And so you lose Toffoli and Markstrom and Tanev in free agency, right? And, you know, you kind of cut things to the bone in terms of depth and change your orientation. And then the very next year, they do the OEL trade. It's like faucet on, faucet off, faucet on. Three times in a 12-month period, and it took Jim Rutherford and Al Levine 2 years to sort it out, right? Those quick, abrupt turns in strategy, whether it's political, whether it's budgetary, whether it's how you're assessing your team. Well, now it's time for us to go all in because we're ahead of schedule. Those switches, I think, are death in a hard cap system.
They certainly are. One final note on this, and then we're going to take a break, and then we'll get into like specifics with teams. I was thinking about the timing of the deadline as well. Do you think that we're at the right spot in terms of like how late into the season it is? Because on the one hand, I think the reason why you do it that way is like you want to build up as much of a sample as you can to give teams an idea of where they stand. And hopefully like it's not really the case right now because like half the league is on the bubble basically.
Yep.
But this idea that there will be some sort of clarity and delineation between playoff teams and teams who should sell. But I couldn't help but think, and while this was all happening, if the deadline had been a month ago or even 3 weeks ago, like the Penguins might have kept Gensel. And then obviously he gets hurt, right?
Right.
That's sort of an anomaly. But the Predators certainly, I think, would have traded like everyone.
Yeah.
And now they wound up, like they trade Trenin, who was an impending UFA and who we both like.
They extend Novak.
They keep Carrier. They bring in Sucker, obviously, for really cheap because they could just take his full contract from Arizona. And they bring in Beauvillier as well for nothing to replace Trenin. But yeah, like, they would have, I think, just traded pretty much everyone a month ago. And I don't think there's a right or wrong answer in that regard, because I don't think for their perspective, whatever they would have gotten back based on the prices we saw for Alex Carey, I don't think that's going to impact how good they are 3 years from now, right? No. It would have been like a mid-round pick. Yeah. Whereas now there's fun, good vibes team that's going to give someone trouble in round one. I think there is value to that. But it's interesting to think about like how different the trade deadline would have looked on February 8th as opposed to March 8th.
Fascinating, right? And then you have things that like look sage in retrospect. Obviously, I'm focused on the Canucks. They don't push in more chips after acquiring Lindholm. And then the first game, the day after the deadline, Thatcher Demko leaves with injury.
Right.
And it's like, could you imagine the conversation right now if they'd bought, like if they'd parted with additional assets, right? I mean, it would be wild. One of the winners, under the radar winners of the trade deadline, though, the Milwaukee Admirals. Right? Because now they're not sending half their team up to be blooded in the NHL.
Yep.
Now they just get to keep wrecking everybody in the A. Love that.
That's true. That's a good point. Okay, let's take a break here. And then when we come back, we'll pick things right back up with Thomas Drance. You are listening to the Hockey PDOcast streaming on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
Hitting the most important topics for Vancouver sports fans. The People's Show with Vic Nizar. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
On the Hockey PDOcast with Thomas Drance. Tom, we kind of took a theoretical view, I guess, of what happened at the deadline in part one. We were talking about some concepts we saw. Yeah, you know, had the weekend to think about it, so bounce around some ideas. Now let's get into talking about the team specifically. And I'm not necessarily going to like break down every single trade because I think we've already done that by Friday. I think it's more interesting to kind of run through where teams stand right now, and in particular the cup picture, right? Because while... Right. While the playoff picture is muddled, I think that sort of inner circle of teams is crystallizing for us. Mm-hmm. And I think the cup odds sort of reflect that as well, right? Like you've got like a couple teams at the top and then another tier put together. And then all of a sudden, by the time you get to like the Leafs and the Kings in terms of the betting odds, you're starting to talk like real long shots there. And
14-1.
Yes. Which I think classifies, right? Compared to some of the other ones. So let's play a little game here in the final 25 minutes, and I'm going to let you pitch the idea to our listeners, and then we're going to get into it and have some fun with it.
Yeah, I was listening to Bill Simmons, as one does, and they were doing one word for why each team wouldn't win the NBA championship. I don't want to go negative like that. That's not my style. but I was thinking, what if we did one word to characterize? So let's define it as like the top 14 that cuts us off at Tampa Bay.
Okay.
Top 14 teams in the league. And maybe we throw in the Devils as like a 15th team, or unless you want to do Buffalo too, because we love Buffalo so much and they were interested.
I think we should just run through as many teams as we can. We got 25 minutes here. Why not? If we're doing one word, I mean, that's 25 words or whatever. Yeah,
but you know us, that means we spend 45 minutes on the Calgary Flames. Right. Anyway, let's do one word for just a one word summary of each team's outlook on the other side of the trade deadline. Now that it's passed.
Okay.
Should we start with Florida?
Yeah, let's do it. So you want to do East, and we'll work our way through.
I was going to do full league.
Okay, let's do it. Let's do Florida.
Yeah.
Go first.
By points. Florida, one word. So the Panthers, obviously. Okay. I'll go with this.
Are we allowed to hyphenate stuff?
No.
Oh. Okay.
Desirable.
Okay. Nice.
I'm going with desirable for the Florida Panthers because the two things that happened to them at the deadline where they got this steal of a deal done with Tarasenko, where he completely guided himself to...
It was a one-team market.
Sunny Isles.
Yep.
One-team market. So they are able to pay 60 cents on the dollar relative to like the Toffoli price for a guy who fits them really, really well. And they were able to get Forsling on a contract that looks like one of the best in the league. To me... This was like the Florida Panthers flexing the desirability of their destination, their no tax logic, the fact that they have a majority Russian suburb, a 25-minute drive from the game rink. Like all of that congeals to give them this massive edge in the pursuit of free agents, in the pursuit of big name talent, in the pursuit of players with any degree of leverage over their own situation. I love Vladimir Tarasenko. Desirable.
I like that. I mean, that's way better than mine. I was going to go with complete. Just because I think that they had so little work to do in terms of their needs relative to other teams. I'm not that high on Tarasenko at this point of his career, as we talked about last year when the Rangers acquired him. But I think, obviously, based on the price they paid, which you described why it was so low, but you just watch him and it's like, all right, if he's going to be playing with Reinhardt and Barkov and just going to add another scoring option while also bumping Nick Cousins down to the fourth line, like that's all they needed. Get Okpozo for cheap, gives them like fourth line defensive value. I mean, it's a no-brainer. It was a perfect trade deadline for them, looping in the Forsling extension as well. And yeah, they're becoming a destination for tax purposes, for weather, for winning, right? And I think that's important. Like, they're becoming a place where you're going to see more and more players trying to get there. Like, it's great.
And don't undersell. I mean, that practice facility now that's in Fort Lauderdale, right? The game rink location remains an issue from a commercial standpoint. But from a player lifestyle perspective, like, you're living in Fort Lauderdale. Yes, you're driving 25 minutes to games, but on practice days, most of the time, even morning skates, you're taking a golf cart to a completely renovated practice facility that has like barbecue facilities outside for the players. Like, it's a nice life, bud.
And that's important, because that's something we obviously don't really talk much about, because we're just like evaluating on ice stuff typically. But like, and we talk about this in Vegas, when in terms of spending, it's not just player salaries. It's like other organizational stuff that makes you a place where players want to come and play and spend however many years, right? Like, that's an important thing. Okay, next team?
Canucks,
okay.
Do you want to go first?
No. I'll let you go first on all of these, because I feel like your brain works more quickly because you got such a handle on the English vocabulary. Right. I gotta think a little bit on it.
I'm going to go with proactive.
Okay.
Right? The Canucks were quiet in the final month leading up to the deadline, which obscured just how many in-season trades they've made. I mean, dating back to like the day that teams reported to training camp, it was like Pearson out to Smith in with a pick, then Lafferty in for a mid-round pick. Then you had Zadorov, you know, as part of a two-trade sequence, which also sent out Beauvillier. And then you had Elias Lindholm a month before the draft. So it's like, in grand total, the Canucks were such an outlier for so many months in terms of aggressively tweaking and sort of just like subtly raising the floor of their group. Floor was the other one I was debating for the Canucks. That they then are quiet at the deadline. And again, because I think their method of improving sort of defied convention, I think it confused people. There was some hand-wringing in this market that they hadn't gone in hard enough, given how, you know, significant a dream season that club has authored to this point. And yet, I think on balance, you'd look at them as like an active team in season. It's just that it came a little earlier than we were used to. And I think sort of made understanding it, wrapping your head around a quiet deadline day, a little bit more difficult than it probably should have been. This club, frankly, did a lot of the stuff that you'd look for a team to do at the deadline as a contender. It's just that they were way out ahead of, like, we bolstered our goalie depth, we bolstered our fourth line, we brought in a big fast fourth liner, we bolstered our defensive depth, and we bolstered our center depth. It's just that it was done beforehand.
Yes, I'll go with proactive's good. I'll go with understandable, because I wish, obviously, like everyone, they would have brought in another top six wing so you could bump Mikheyev out of a spot like that and really round everything out. They didn't have the resources in terms of picks to go out and bring in a Toffoli. They didn't have the cap space to go out and just absorb Jason Zucker. So, like, their hands were tied in that regard. At the same time, though, they made a lot of their moves before. So I think we need to loop all of that in. I think, like, the fact they didn't do anything on a Friday can't really be held against them, because you have to look at the totality of what they did previously, even going back to, like, getting Lafferty for a fifth in the week before the season starts, right? Like, I think all of that matters. This team, though, it's interesting because they went through that brief little stretch. I think they went 1-5-1 to end February.
Yeah.
And then I had people going like, oh, PDO even fooled the PDO cast. Like, I can't believe, like, they bought this team. I was like, all right, let's hold our horses here. And this was the first bit of adversity they'd faced in the first 5 months of the season. So I think people were like surprised by it because
the other shoe has finally dropped.
Yeah. And it's like, I keep saying this, I just implore people to actually watch these games. I understand not everyone, if you're not living here locally, you're not a fan of the team, you're not going to be watching all 32 teams. But I think taking a big picture view of this and actually seeing how this stuff is coming together is very important.
I think regression has hit for them, though, in terms of especially the shooting percentage.
Yes.
And for about a month there, every mistake they made, like at an unsustainable rate of every, like, they weren't making a ton of them, but every time they made a mistake, it was in the back of their net. But their process, really since the new year, but like especially since the All-Star break, even on that 1-5-1 7-game stretch, that might have been their most impressive hockey of the season, or at least right next to it. Like, they were good.
Other than the Minnesota game.
See, even then, if you go watch that Minnesota game closely, like, they didn't deserve the 5-2 lead that they built.
Right.
But as their penalty kill started sputtering, the Wild take the lead 6-5. Go watch the 4 minutes between that and when Marco Rossi kicks a puck into the Canucks net, like just an absolute bounce. They probably had like 6 great A's.
No, I know.
Turned it up. Like, that was honestly, that Minnesota game, everyone else was losing their minds, and I'm watching it and I'm thinking, this is the best version of this team.
No, I see what you're saying. I'm just saying it through the lens of the way they've gone about their business this year, especially like going into thirds of the lead has been like so locked down. And then that was like really the only instance I can think of where it got sloppy, and part of it wasn't their own doing. There's calls, there's balances, like that happens over the course of a game and over the course of a season. But that's just what I mean in that perspective. Demko's out right now for a couple weeks, it sounds like, right? Yeah. But this is a good part of the schedule to do so because they have like two games the next 8 days. There's no back-to-backs until the end of the month. Where it becomes interesting is in April, where they have a couple games against Vegas. They play Winnipeg again at the end of the season.
Edmonton.
They play Edmonton, LA one more time, I believe. And so like it'll be curious to see
twice
where the schedule is like at that point. Where the standings are like at that point, because on the one hand, they're first in the West right now. On the other hand, we'll see where Vegas is at, because for a while, we kept talking about how winning the West as the one seed was very important because you would get a cake matchup in round one. And then now that's becoming a bit less clear.
Now you might face the most volatile team in hockey that could get Hurdle and Stone back at some point in that
series. Okay, let's keep going because we can do more on the Canucks. But okay, Bruins. I'll go first. I thought about this one. Delayed.
Yeah.
And what I mean by that is they didn't do anything of note, really. They brought in Andrew Peak, who I do not like as a player, although going from Columbus to Boston, we've seen this. I'm sure he's going to rattle off an amazing 20 games of underlying numbers, and we're going to go like, oh, of course.
This is the reverse Connor Carrick. Not Connor Carrick. Who's the guy Buffalo signed that I loved?
Connor Clifton. Yes.
This is the reverse Connor Clifton.
Yes. Yeah. And we see this all the time. Like, the defensemen are so dependent on situation, and going from a horribly run team to a team that constantly is so structured and getting the most out of their players. Like it's going to happen again, but they bring in him and they bring him in Maroon, right? There's that report that they tried to trade Allmark, but couldn't. Looking ahead to this summer though, with Grizzlick, DeBrusque and Forbort, they're clearing about like $11 million in cap space. They have no internal pay raises coming compared to most teams, right? They're going to have to pay Swayman, but I think they're going to just trade Allmark this summer and they're going to account for that salary discrepancy. They get access to their 2025 first, because I think this year's is going to be conveyed to Detroit. And so all of a sudden, and it's Marchand's last year at $6 million or whatever he makes. Like, I think the Bruins are the team to watch this summer in terms of like throwing haymakers. And so it's delayed because they didn't do anything, but I think it's a storm's brewing.
I was going to go with realistic.
Mm.
You know, there's so many moments where you're watching the Bruins, you're like, how are you doing this? And then you're like, wow, I can't believe Pasternak just cut into the middle somehow to get a glorious chance when he's on the ice with. And then you look at who he's on the ice with, and it's like four absolute guys, not a dude to be seen, you know? And I just think they know, having gone for it with reckless abandon, with abandon the year prior. I think they know that this isn't the year to spend if they're going to realistically like win in this, new Pasternak-McAvoy window. And I think they kept their powder dry and were right to do so based on a realistic assessment of where they're at. Dallas. You want to go? Or you want me to go?
You go. Go for it.
I'm going to just go with internal.
Oh, yeah, I was thinking that.
Yeah, I'm just going to go with internal. I think, obviously, they did do stuff, right? I mean, Chris Tanev was the priciest defenseman that moved on the market. And I like the fit for them for a variety of reasons, mostly that Tanev's the man. But ultimately, the big ad that they're making here is Logan Stankoven, right? Like, that's the ability of this Stankoven-Johnston nexus to fundamentally alter, as Braden Point did once upon a time in Tampa Bay, sort of what the ceiling of this team might be going into the playoffs. Like, that didn't happen because of what they brought in. That couldn't have happened based on what they brought in. But because they're able to promote Logan Stankoven and get this like instant, totally new gear in their offensive machinery, I think that's their biggest deadline acquisition. And honestly, I've had a multi-year fade position on this Stars group, and suddenly I'm feeling far less confident about that, given what we've seen those two young guys do together and individually over the course of the past 2 weeks. Fascinated to see how it plays out down the stretch and into the playoffs.
I'm going to go with methodical.
Mm.
The dictionary definition, I looked this up because I wanted to make sure. Done according to a systematic or established form or procedure. I cannot think of anything more than the Dallas Stars calling a young player up and getting immediate success out of him while also acquiring a player without moving a first or a top prospect. It's like, this is Jim Neal Stars, and they executed to perfection. So give me methodical.
I like that. All right.
The New York Rangers?
Let's go to the Rangers. Do you want to go first? I'm going to keep asking you.
No, I don't.
Understated.
Mm. Right.
The New York Rangers eschewed the marquee names that have so often been their downfall my entire adult life and went out and got some guys. And I think guys that will genuinely help them. I mean, Alexander Wennberg is not my cup of tea necessarily. I know the underlying numbers have always been relatively decent on him. He's not my cup of tea, but as your third line center, if the job description is third line center, I think he's an awesome fit for them. Chad Ruedel. I actually like Chad Ruedel a lot, but like if him and Zach Jones is your fourth pair, you know, there's not a lot of injuries that you can, or you're going to have to sustain a lot of injuries on the back end before you're even getting like 12 minutes you're not all that comfortable with.
Well, you got to win the press box matchup as well. So
you do. And Nick Petan will help on that
score
as well. Like Nick Petan, honestly, can absolutely give an NHL team like 10 safe minutes a game where he helps the fourth line like play those gentleman's agreement minutes and actually outshoot. Maybe not outscore, but outshoot their opponents. He was good in a depth role in Vancouver during that Bruce There It Is bump time. Like, if he's your fourth line left wing in a key playoff game, you're 0% worried about him. And then Jack Roslovic, I know that they tried to get Barabanov. Whatever, right? Like, whatever. Like, if you get anything from him, that's kind of gravy. But I do think he at least fits the mold of, you know, a little bit of offensive punch in their bottom six, which I think can help. And then also, I think he's kind of sneaky good operating from the flank on the power play. I think he can actually help them there, you know, in the event of an injury to a PP1 guy or on PP2.
Is there a word that would kind of encompass, like, a slow burn or, like, a growing on me? Because that's what I'm thinking of with this team right now.
Like sneaky?
Sneaky. Let's go with sneaky. Because on the one hand, I initially wanted them to make a big splash. I thought Guentzel would have made a ton of sense, and they were sort of a finalist for that. I talked about how Toffoli would have been a perfect fit, and I'm sure the Devils just didn't want to trade him to him. So they go with Wennberg and Roslovic, and I'm like, in isolation, I don't necessarily love either player. But then you look at their depth chart right now and the way they've constructed their top three lines in particular – and they've got Wennberg centering Will Cooley, who I really like, and they bump Kaapo Kakko down, and I bet that line is going to have phenomenal 5-on-5 numbers.
Oh, yeah.
And then they have Roslovic playing with Zibanejad and Kreider and kind of like helping push the pace a little bit and maybe create more space along with Kreider for Zibanejad to get a shot off at 5-on-5. And then you've obviously got that second line, or I guess their first line, with Panarin, Trocheck, and Lafreniere. All of a sudden, like, I like how those pieces fit much more than I would have just necessarily being like, how do I rate Rembrandt as a player or how do I rate Roslovic? So, sneaky's good. The Winnipeg Jets.
Do you have one?
Needed.
Yeah, I was going to go targeted.
They had to do something. Like, obviously, they were kind of a first responder to the Monahan trade. But then, after what Dallas did, after what Colorado did in particular, adding those four guys, they had to do something the day of the deadline. They went out and got Toffoli for an unbelievably affordable price, and they just got walloped by the Canucks in their most recent game. It was the second of a back-to-back. They didn't have two top six wingers in Vilardi and Toffoli.
And they scratched Perfetti for some reason.
Well, they've been doing that for a while because Rick Bonus insists on being on brand.
David Gustafson season, baby.
Fully formed, though, if they can get all those guys on the ice at the same time. I love that forward group and how everything fits together. And it was needed. Like, they had to do it, and they accomplished it. And so I give them full marks for that.
So I was going to go with targeted, because what do Colin Miller, Tyler Toffoli, and Sean Monahan all have in common? Punch up your power play.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's like, now, I know there's mitigating reasons why you haven't been concerned about the Jets' power play, given sort of the injury flow for them throughout the season. But, like, at the end of the day, Toffoli's as good and smart a net front guy who can also play on the flanks on the power play as you'll find. Sean Monahan's sick in the bumper, and Colin Miller's, like, honestly one of the most dangerous shooting right-handed defensemen. It's just that there's other holes in his game that have sort of stopped him from ever holding down, like, a full-time NHL PP1 role. But there's things that he can do, like some of the best in the league, in that spot. I just think, in terms of just a targeted addressing of this club's biggest remaining flaw. I thought they accomplished that. Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just gonna go with fast. Like, yeah. I just now. Casey Mittelstadt's not exactly a burner in terms of his straight line speed, but the way he plays is fast. Like he'll and when you're upgrading over Ryan Johansson, you know, that's a huge injection of speed. Bowen Byram can play fast and does a lot of things well, but Sean Walker is quicker in terms of the way that he plays. Yeah, the Trennan, Duhaime guys don't add speed necessarily. That's more of a
Trennan does, especially as a forechecker. He's going to get in there and he's going to punish you. So,
do you think we get to see him ever play like a new age Bash Brothers like third line with Nichushkin?
Yeah,
because that'd be
see,
fun.
I could see it. Yeah,
with Ross Colton.
Yeah, I mean, especially now with Logan O'Connor. Unfortunately, PDO Casiero, Logan O'Connor out for the season. Like in hindsight, in particular, it's like adding those two guys to give them wing depth is huge. Mm-hmm. So
yeah, I just think they leaned into their stylistic preferences in a really sharp way that, you know, Mittelstadt's not exactly like a known quantity. It's not like there's no risk to these deals, but this was a move that feels like they're really comfortable in their own skin. They know who they are. They know how they want to play, if it's going to work, and it needs to be speed. Speed and possession. I thought they made moves that really amplified what they do well.
I'll go creative because they actually did a one-for-one hockey trade, trading a young defenseman with upside for a young forward, roughly same age, that can help them much more. They got much better. They were very aggressive in doing so. And I think like the Oilers, who we'll talk about in a second here, would have loved to trade Cody Ceci to improve at that position. But I think they bumped into the resistance of the fact that very few teams wanted to take on $3.25 million of salary next year. And I think that cannot be understated for like the price the Avalanche paid to get off of Ryan Johansson's $4 million next season and get Sean Walker back. Like, that was not Sean Walker for a first-round pick. It was a lifeline and Sean Walker for a first-round pick. And so that was awesome. So I'll give them creative. The Carolina Hurricanes.
Oh, man. I'm going to go with... I'm just going to go with volatile. I think the Carolina Hurricanes could come out of this deadline as by far the most improved team in hockey, or they just didn't do enough. And I have no idea. Like, I have no idea what Kuznetsov's going to contribute, but it could be amazing. And Gensel, I mean, they acquired a hurt guy, like a guy who's injured at the moment. But, man, I mean, I think he's the absolute perfect fit for how Rod Brind'Amour wants to play. You know, and I think there's going to be a sense of confidence that they can retain him. So I sort of look at Gensel and Kuznetsov and just think there's a real chance that we're looking back and saying that this team put themselves over the top at the deadline. But there's also a chance that this is absolutely nothing. And that to me is fascinating.
Which is fine. I will go a swing because they took a swing.
Yeah.
Right. That's all we wanted from them.
Yeah.
We just wanted them to push chips into the middle of the table. Add a player who out of their comfort zone, and I didn't even see the Kuznetsov one coming. I would have still went with swing just purely based on Gensel. And honestly, I'm viewing the Kuznetsov thing as like total found money if they get anything from him the rest of the way. So when you look at models that are like disagree or like rating their trade deadline poorly because they're factoring in how he played on the Capitals, I'm almost viewing it as like a zero in terms of like he might not play. So if he's a negative value, he just won't play for them because they're not needing him at this point. So whatever they get from him is found money. Swing. Like Gensel, they needed it. They went for it. They won out on him, battling with a team they're probably going to play in round two in the Rangers. And so I got to go with swing there.
Yeah, I like that.
The Toronto Maple Leafs. I'll go with truculent. I was going to go with some less favorable words, but let's go with truculent.
Yeah, it's a very good pick.
So... the irony of this year's team and their defensive metrics and the players are going out and getting compared to previous ones that were ridiculed for being too soft defensively and too porous, yet posting great defensive results anyway in the regular season. This year's team is down to 21st in expected goals against defensively. They spent 2/3, 1/4, 1/5, and 2/6 for Lyubushkin, Edmondson, Connor Dewar, and Cade Weber signing rights. And it's a small price to pay for a contender to get better in pursuit of a Stanley Cup. I'm just questioning very strongly whether any of that was actually in service of accomplishing that. And so I'm Yeah, there's nothing new to add because look at his blue line. Like, they're relying so heavily now on Jake McCabe and TJ Brody, the latter of whom is not the player he once was, and their numbers are not very good together in the limited time they've played, and they're going to have to basically eat every tough defensive matchup for this team.
When you, as a big defensive defender in the contemporary NHL, when you lose that ability to, like, turn and still be defensively effective, things get really dicey for you in a hurry. And I think we've passed that line with Joel Edmondson. No, I don't need to look at a single pie chart.
Yeah, many years ago.
To think that. Okay. Many years ago. It's been more pronounced this year, even.
I saw of how many playoff series or whatever he's won in his career compared to every other defender they have was legitimately one of the funniest things in broadcasting history. The last one we're going to do, let's cut it off at an even 10 here because we're running out of time. The Edmonton Oilers.
Okay. I want to do the Devils though.
I'm going to go measured.
Okay. Can we do Devils and Oilers?
Sure. I'm doing measured. I think it's somewhat of a half measure. They moved the first in 2024 to get Henrique, right? And they brought in Sam Carrick and Troy from Richmond, who was an all-time dude. At the same time, though, in the lead-up to the deadline, we identified top six wing with finishing talent and a top six right shot. A top two pair right shot. And they didn't really address either directly. Now, Henrique gives them more versatility with Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and Dreisaitl and McLeod as like a bunch of centers they can mix and match in the top six and on the wings and sitting down the middle. And Troy from Richmond always works his way higher up the depth chart than he's initially planned for. So we could in the playoffs see those upgrades pay dividends, but at the same time right now, they didn't really accomplish what I was hoping they would.
Yeah, underwhelming. I'd go with underwhelming. I just think given the assets paid, because they gave up some premium stuff and the pieces landed, I just don't feel like they got as much bang for their buck as some of the teams like Vegas and on and on. I just want to do the Devils really quick because I thought they had a fascinating deadline.
Was this entire game just like...
No. I don't actually have my word
for you to do a Devils
one? I'm searching for it. I'm going to go with the word look because I thought it was interesting that the Devils went and got two goalies despite being a seller team.
Well, I think I think they've said as much that the Sharks one with Kakanen was purely to get off of Vanacek's money next year, which was huge.
Right.
Like the fact that the Sharks did that for them is wild.
At the cost of a seventh?
Truly insane.
Yeah.
And so
I'm not sure what the Sharks were doing.
Tanking.
Yeah.
So I think that's clear. Look is interesting. I will go with future because I don't think either of these were with the design of salvaging this season. Although I'm sure like adding Jake Allen will just help them a little bit. But I think like they're going to get their goalie net this summer.
I agree with you, but I do think that they at least made moves designed to allow them to evaluate what they have. You know, not emotionally being like, okay, a lot of what's happened to us is goaltending, but maybe not all of it. Let's see what we have if we have baseline competence in net. And I think that was the motivator. And I think that applies to players on the team, how they play. I suspect it applies to interim head coach Travis Green. Feels like they set themselves up to at least take a sober look, as we're trying to do, at the trade deadline, but at their team down the balance of the season.
I like that.
The balance of the season.
Tom, in fitting fashion, we went into this exercise hoping to do up to 15 to 20 teams. We got through 10.
Yeah.
But we got through the 10 important ones, plus the Devils at 11.
How long will it take? It's one word.
Amazing. Tom, everyone follow Thomas Drance online and listen to Canucks Talk here on the Sportsnet Radio Network. We'll be back tomorrow with Daryl Bellevue returning after a week off. Ooh. We're going to do Logan Stankoven, so look forward to that one.
Let's go.
And join the Discord, as we talked about. We'll take your questions from there in the future. Invite link is in the show notes. Get in there. That's all for today. We'll be back tomorrow with plenty more of the Hockey PDO cast. So until then, thank you for listening to us on the Sportsnet Radio Network.